November the 25th, Thanksgiving Day.
82EV.
Yeah, Era Vocal Eras, here in California. This is the second tape of this tape. We actually did make you a tape a few weeks ago, and it was either lost or stolen, and finally we were remaking this tape once yet again. Therefore, I am Lola DeWolf, and sitting here on my right is the great one and only Hymenaeus Alpha Grady McMurtry, outer head of the order, OTO, illustrious, whatever all the titles would be. Okay, Grady, the first question here for Unicorn Magazine is, when was the California section of the OTO established, and what are its legitimations?
This question must be answered in two parts. First of all, the OTO came to California officially, so far as we know, through my 40 years of experience, with Agape Lodge, which is to say with Wilford Smith. Wilford Smith is supposed to have met Aleister Crowley in Canada sometime in the 20s, or maybe early 30s, I'm not quite sure exactly, but the point is, he met him, a number of things happened, and as a result, Wilford Smith came to California, and in Los Angeles, which is a place in Hollywood called Winona Boulevard, he had for many years something called Agape Lodge. This was the only functioning OTO lodge at the time of Crowley's death. And so this was the OTO in California. And then, of course, however, the OTO in England with Aleister Crowley, this was, of course, in the 30s, I knew him in the 40s. And his main anchor in the United States was Carl Germer, a former German officer in the Kaiser's army who had, as a Stalinite, had been persecuted by the Nazis and expelled from Germany through a concentration camp before a lot of other things happened, and was for years in New York City, worked there, and acted as Crowley's bank account, basically, voluntarily. He was Grand Treasurer General of the Order, and it was his job to send Aleister Crowley $200 a month, every month, and how he got it was up to him, and let's say Carl got it the best way he could. And so then when Crowley died, Germer, by that time, at the time that Crowley died, Agape Lodge was in a state of transition leading to dissolution, which would happen finally after Jack Parsons was killed in a chemical blast involving his jet propulsion lab functions. In any case, the Ogilvie Lodge continued for a number of years and finally disintegrated. I was a member of Ogilvie Lodge. I was initiated into the OTO in Ogilvie Lodge, Almano Boulevard in Hollywood, about 1938 or 39. In any case, that was the end of Ogilvie Lodge, and then the end of the OTO as known up to then, which is Alistair Crowley to Carl Germer, his outer head of the order, following his Crowley's death. When Germer died, he left no heir, he left no will. He died intestate, so far as the order was concerned, which left, of course, a vacuum. And so in that sense, we can say that Fratres Eternus, Carl Germer, grounded the order in the sense that when he died, the library, Crowley's library, was left unguarded except for Sasha Germer, who has original name was Ashkenaz. She was a Viennese voice teacher. When I knew her, her name was Sasha André. Of course, she was Mrs. Germer.
And she's not a member of the OTO.
Oh, yes. And it is very important to point out that she was never a member of the OTO. We have this in our personal handwriting to prove that. In any case, Germer left no heir, and he left no order. The reason he didn't leave an order is because, the reason I know he didn't is because I was the only one in the 1950s who tried to get the Ogilvie Lodge members back together again and tried to, continue the tradition of the order, only to find it all of us, it was impossible. It was a case that the phoenix must die before it can be reborn, says. And so when Germer died, the library left unguarded in the hands of this little old Jewish lady from Vienna, who obviously didn't know what to do with it. And so she sat on it a few years, made the mistake of notifying a few people like Peregrinus in Switzerland that Germer was dead. He died in 1962. And she did not inform me because I was in Washington, D.C. at that time. And her relations with me, she wouldn't have told me anything. In any case,
she was rather against the order, in fact, wasn't she?
Well,
didn't she think we were black magicians and so forth?
I don't know what, all I know is that Sasha Germer had many strange visions, and why Carl let her influence him can only be explained in terms of a higher magic, which, as I said, would have Germer ground the order as the current, who ground the Thelemic current at West Point on a farm outside there, until I would come by a few years later and release it by a banishing ritual, the same banishing ritual as you had on the tape here. In any case, as I said, I opposed Germer's policy of not initiating. When I broached the subject to him, I said, "Carl, the order is dying. We must initiate." And he said, "No." And I have this in writing someplace.
He wouldn't said, initiate you either, would he, to a higher degree?
No, he would not. I never asked, and he never volunteered to initiate me to a higher degree. But then Crowley had made me a ninth degree in London in 1943-44, so it didn't matter.
Right.
In any case, I asked Carl to initiate, and he said no. And he said, "I call all that the lower magic," unquote. Well, damn to hell, it may be lower magic, all right, but in this particular universe, if you don't have people who are initiated, then order dies. So we can say that the order died with it. Now, the order was reborn, a phoenix-like, through two acts, as it were. One, when in 1969-70, in San Francisco, California, and a place called Acaba Clerk House at the 4411 Balboa Street, which is now a Turkish restaurant, whose the proprietor's name is the Mahdi, which seems to me like a karma. In any case, I was able to get the Thoth deck published in color, which was the big hang-up point. And I got my authorization from Gerald York. I got it from him because the paintings that are the Thoth deck belong to Lady Frieda Harris. Now, by British law, a painting belongs to the artist, not the person who designed it. Now, Crowley thought they belonged to him, but he was wrong by British law. When she died, she willed them to Gerald York, and Gerald York has placed them in the Warburg Institute in London, and I obtained his permission by proving to him through a Xerox copy of a receipt that Crowley had sent me in 1943-44, whenever it was, that I'd just given him £50 to publish the Book of Thoth, to get the Book of Thoth published was all he needed to get it out. And so Gerald York gave me a first return for 1 year to publish the cards, and they were published. And in that year, I was faced with the fact that the order was dead. Gorman was dead, the order was dead, everything had stopped, as it were.
There were about five members left, though.
There were five members, but of course there was no organization. There were just people who would run into each other on occasion and knew each other, but there was no organization. But I knew as soon as we got the Thospec published, it would establish a new vibration. And however, I was all by myself, and so I just stood up there in this empty storefront that we were going to make a publishing firm, and I decided to accept the burden of the caliphate. Because, one, I had the letters from Crowley written to me on the battlefields of France during World War II, after the invasion of Normandy, telling me that he had a plan for me to be his caliph, what it meant to be his caliph, and what he thought, why he felt I was uniquely qualified. The reason he thought I was uniquely qualified was because he said, quote, because of your blooding on a battlefield right now, during the war, when I was fighting the Germans and from Normandy to Nuremberg. I was an ammunition supply officer, by the way. I hope this doesn't disappoint anybody. I was first lieutenant, I guess you'd call that an Oberleutnant. But anyway, I was an ammunition supply officer for a fighter bombing unit of P-47s. That's two 500-pound bombs apiece and 850 calibers. And I was with them from Normandy, northern France, the Rhineland, and of course Central Europe. Now.
Okay, let us go on to the next question.
Yes.
Okay. In short, what is the aim of your work and how is it organized? That is, lodges, chapters, and etc. If I could just mention quickly, I've included the latest magical link, so it has a list of all of our chapters, lodges, and encampments on the back page there, so he'll be able to see what the addresses are. But the aim of our work, what is the aim of our work? Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law.
Yes, do what thou wilt is the whole of the law. The aim of our work comes on many levels. It depends upon whether it is personal or organizational. The aim of our work in terms of personal is always exactly one thing, and that is to find your own true will and to follow it. Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law, love the law, love under will. In terms of organization, we band ourselves together into an initiate fraternity simply because we find it congenial to work with others of like mind, and we find that since some of us know more than others, we have teachers and we have students. And so our aim is to further the law of Thelema, the Thelemic current, as we call it, the 92 current, if you prefer, and to see that this is realized as far as possible in this universe. Next.
Yes, and also, of course, the initiations, that power.
Oh, yes, and we, yes, thank you, Lola, for reminding me. Yes, for initiation, we insist upon physical contact. That is to say, somebody has to meet somebody. We do not initiate by mail or on the astral, however. We do accept associate membership, people who would like to be initiated or just to get our newsletter, in case any being, for a certain fee in the year. And this allows them at least to get our publications and to write to us many times simply because of distance. We can't do a physical initiation. And that is the way that works, yes?
Okay. Who was or is Aleister Crowley for you?
Well, if you mean to meet personally, of course, he was a very good friend, he was my prophet. And that's a funny thing. I never, I was ever obsequious with him, but I was always very respectful. It was like he was, as it were, a commanding officer, and I was reporting for duty in that sense. After all, I wasn't in the Army at the time. It was very natural. But people have said, well, what was it like to meet Aleister Crowley? Well, I don't know what other people thought, but for me, when I walked in the door at 93 German Street, on October the 31st, 1943 EV, what I saw in front of me was a very, shall we say, if I may say, proper, a relaxed English gentleman of older years, of course, elderly, I guess, who could, quote, meet you at any level that you were able to meet him, unquote. And my only problem was I was a big dumb kid from Oklahoma, and I was having a problem trying to meet him at any level at all, except that I did meet him at chess once. However, if you want to know what it was like, we sat at 93 German Street with the blackout blinds up on the curtain of the German bombers we could hear upstairs playing chess, smoking Perique and drinking brandy and talking about many things. But if you mean in terms of the organization, and to me, as a Thelemite, he is, first of all, my prophet. He is the one who brought down the Book of the Law. And if you want, And his writings are the Class A documents. There is a book of Class A documents coming out soon, we call the Holy Books. These we consider to be at that level. But then the rest of Crowley's writings is up to anybody to criticize or whatever. We criticize them ourselves or not, or we have fun. But the point is that they're all important.
Yes.
Now, and so as far as the organization is concerned, this is about the way the... We wouldn't be in the organization if we weren't interested in knowledge of Crowley, let me put it that way.
Yes. What is your system of initiations and grades? Is there an 11th degree in your order?
Our system of initiation and grades is exactly as put in the Blue Equinox at the back of the Constitution, where it has a list of fees and so forth. Now, there is one typographical error there. It should be under the third degree, not under the fourth degree, as it's already called. Roland, you remember our little discussion on that? Well, we can write to you this later.
Yeah.
But now let me see.
The zero through third degree is open to
all. Is open to all, yes. And above that, by invitation. Let me see now.
What 11th degree.
Oh, 11th, yes. Do we have an 11th degree? Yes, as a matter of fact, we do. I'm proud to say it. I had a young gentleman by the name of Pat King come to me one day several years ago, and say that he would like to be chartered have a charter for an 11th degree. I was quite happy to grant it to him. There was no, we shook hands. I said, well, give me a piece of paper and I'll take a look at it and see if I like it. He gave me a piece of paper, I liked it, and I sealed off on it. So now Patrick King has the first, as far as I know, probably the only charter I have issued for 11th degree working male from the order. And anybody who wants to be involved with the 11th degree towards the order's concerns, contact Mr. King through the order. The 11th degree female, the lesbian side of the trip, I believe they call it. In any case, a beautiful young lady by the name of Nancy Brooks, a very beautiful friend of mine, came to me and wanted an 11th degree charter for the female side of the order. And I was more than happy to grant it to her on the same conditions. But I liked what I saw, and I sealed off on it. It was fully ring on my hand. And so anybody who is on the female side of the order who's interested in that should check with Nancy. She now calls herself Shawn, S-H-A-U-N Brooks, and she lives in Salt Lake City.
And they can write here.
And you can write here and contact them through us. And for what do we have to do with them, and what do they have to do with us? The answer is absolutely nothing. They do not report to us unless as friends they want to tell us what they're up to, which is entirely up to them. We do not ask them questions. They have no administrative function. They have no control of the order. They have no administrative role in the order. They are very simple. It says right in the Blue Equinox that the 11th degree dwells in its own palaces, and has nothing, and it has nothing to do with the order. However, they're very good friends of ours, and they're very good.
All right, let me see. What is the role of magic in an initiate's life according to OTO doctrine? And the only thought I had on that earlier, Grady, was the fact that if you're a magician, it isn't just a role in your life, it's part of your personality, like being an artist, and you don't just do it part of the time, you're just a magician, or you aren't, you know?
I think that Lola has made the most important point here, far better than I, with my intellectualism, would have made, and that is to say that, to make the distinction right there between the individual and the order as an organization. Now, the order is an organization, it has positions in it, and people fill those positions, but then those people are individuals. So when you say, what is the role of magic in an initiate's life, according to OTO doctrine, you say, you're throwing me a loop, because the OTO doctrine is that the initiate follows his own true will.
Yes.
And so therefore,
it's
following your will. It's like increments of time. That the more you follow your will, the closer you get in time to what it is you're trying to manifest as a filament. And so, you see, it goes in a loop there, that the doctrine is that you should do your will.
Okay. Does the OTO prescribe a fixed syllabus for its members? How free are members in their personal work and evaluation of the order's teachings? Are there any absolute dogmas, and if so, please name them? That's sort of a complicated thing. I thought basically we could just...
Let's just take them one at a time.
Yeah.
You want to hit the first one?
Well, is there a prescribed or fixed syllabus for its members? Well, at zero degree, for example, you learn to do a banishing ritual and you start keeping a diary and you do resh regularly and so forth. But these basic practices are not going to take up a person's full time or even a great chunk of it. You could do all of that in a half hour to an hour a day easily. So other than that, in any degree, a person is free to study anything they want. Karate, Kabbalah, yoga, astrology, anything they want to practice. They're even free if they wish to join other orders than ours and look into teachings. For example, someone might want to go take yoga from a certain teacher somewhere. So they're perfectly free. If it's do what thou wilt shall be the whole law. I mean, that's it. It's do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. It says, how free are members in their personal work and evaluation of the order's teachings? How about the evaluation of the order's teachings, Grady?
Well, that's what we find out from the students by their reaction. Let me go back one moment, just a little way. Now, Lola's answer was absolutely correct, but I think it might miss the point for the German mind. You see, we have to sometimes get the idea that maybe the German has a different logic than the American. Does the OPO prescribe a fixed syllabus for its members?
Well, you see, that would presume that we were an established university, or at least a school. And it also reminds me of whoever wrote a book called The Peter Principle, something about that when organizations reside in marble palaces, those are mausoleums for creative thought. We are living in a universe in which we do not have a fixed syllabus simply because we're still in the process as an organization of establishing our curriculum for the study of students.
Yeah.
You see. Now, that's from an organizational point of view. I think the German mind might possibly understand that we are a college, a collegium, in the process of finding its, getting its own curriculum together so that our students can study.
Yeah.
We have now, after 5-7 years in Berkeley here, the order moved into Berkeley about 7 years ago, we've finally gotten the order to a point where this curriculum project is gaining ground, and this will speed up the momentum with which students can assimilate the material we have to give them. My articles on technical information, the physics of metaphysics and the magical link will give you some idea of where we're heading for.
And also you mean, therefore, that we have classes. We do whole classes every week.
Oh, yes.
Four nights a week, and Heydrich's written some books and so forth.
If you check the calendar, which is on your magical link, you find we have a regular setup of activities at the temple in regard to teaching and so forth. But then much of our teaching is at the home with our friends. Mm-hmm. How free are members in your personal work and evaluation of the order's teachings? Well, let me put it this way. You don't see anybody around the OTU who isn't a volunteer. Nobody gets paid. So if they didn't want to be here, well, that's the way we find out about their evaluation of the order's teachings. They don't show up, and there we go.
Yeah.
Are there any absolute dogmas? If so, please name them. It is a little difficult for an American, I think, and a free-thinking fellow might, to think of absolute dogmas other than, of course, in terms of fully with my prophet and the book of law is true, sort of thing.
Yeah.
But possibly, I think there's a Germans and Americans have a different logic because we just don't think in terms of absolute dogmas and don't think. We think more like in terms of theoretical universes.
Mm-hmm.
What is the role of ritual? Well, if you're wanting to be a ritual magician, well, there's magic in theory and practice, and the rituals that truly laid us out and so forth. And there are other rituals, for example, regarding Golden Dawn, opening the Watchtower, I highly recommend.
Rites of Eloise.
Rites of Eloise is fantastic. Here we have a distinction of 1-2 again, and it's, say, the individual ritual and group ritual. Now individual rituals, of course, Libra Reguli, standard LBRs and all that sort of thing. But then the Greek group ritual begins at Gnostic Mass. It is a basic ritual of the OTO, as of the EGC. But then the rites of Eloise is fantastic. And I must give you a whole different take once some of the little booby traps you might run into when trying to defuse the rites of Eloise. But practice it because you must remember, always treat it with respect, you'll be okay.
Yeah, anyway, ritual can be a very, very handy and good tool for it. It's a
way of establishing yourself in your brotherhood that is very real. The energy builds proportionally. Kabbalah,
We study it extensively. We write articles on it. We have classes on it, yoga. We're not doing as much yoga now as we have, except in individual places. We don't have ashrams yet. I'm not sure we ever will have ashrams. We all always have temples, I would suppose. But we're having, people are getting together for yoga classes. They tell me down at the temple. Lola here and others or somebody is getting together dance classes down here and so forth. Astrology, we believe in astronomy, but we leave it up to the individual. Oh, yes, I'm not just speaking of the German mind and doctrines. We believe in astrology, but we believe in it as individual. That is to say, I have systems that work for me, and Lola has hers and so forth. We don't go around saying, this is the only system, if you know what I mean. Okay, tarot. Yes, we are very much into tarot. We have a tarot reading booth at the Renaissance Fair in Northern California every fall. We have had the last 5 or 6 years. And we teach tarot and find a great deal of our initiatory experience through the tarot. Invocation and evocation are simply refer you to magic and theory and practice. I mean, this is standard and so forth in the OPO teachings.
Okay,
question. Okay.
What role does sexual magic play in the OTO?
Mm-hmm. None publicly. And insofar as private, as far as that is concerned, information supposedly is confined to 9th degrees, of which there are several. As for individual and private, I mean, that's insofar as any knowledge is, public knowledge is concerned. Let me put it this way. There were no papers that were sealed off in wax being passed out in the days of Augury Lodge. In those days, if a person was a known 9th degree, well, then the person they were living with was, after several years, presumed also to be a 9th degree, but since they were both Thelemites, that would be natural. However, this is all very informal. It was simply the legend, which are the facts of the reality, the creative mist out of which we came. And so, like, for example, Helen Parsons Smith had lived with Wilson Smith, and it was his day acknowledged the 9th degree. Phyllis Sector, once part-time Phyllis McMurtry, is in Nottingham's 9th degree. And, well, this girl, people would not
okay.
be named.
Okay,
until.
Well, then, basically, though,
but for the individual, it's a matter of self-initiation in the sense that there is no formal instruction.
Until, like, the 7th through 9th degree and 11th degree are sexual degrees and have
But you can read, freely read documents in Francis King's book
that
and secret teaching
yes,
at OTO.
Yes, and the sexual rituals are the important part of Crowley's magic, but it's on an individual basis in the order that most people are working on these, you know, through his writings and different things.
Yes, each person interprets Crowley differently, and this also includes this matter of sex. Oh, I might add.
Yes.
Or as I might add, the question arises as to the following the instructions of the Gnostic Mass about the pieces to Sprovi. This is a matter of individual interpretation depending upon the words of Barbara's country. Barbara's country could be your own city block, like Fort Apache, the Bronx, or something like that. If it is your group will and the priestess will to disrobe, she has the option according to the instructions. We usually presume that you would do it as a private ritual. If she does not, nothing says she has to. As a matter of order history, Regina Call, according to Jane Wolfe, as I understand it, had this thing whereby she would had her robe, a beautiful blue robe, so that when she undid the cord, when she was seated behind the veil, I might add, that she could bring this robe before Nuit, as it were, and then, of course, put her robe back together before the veil was parted. In some OTO sections where they have strong Wiccan or pagan contacts, where the male and female in the Wiccan ceremonies quite often have what they call sky-clad rituals, indoors or outdoors, as the case may be. Usually outdoors is in some woods, some secluded place. It is natural for the young ladies to take off their clothing, and so it's also natural, I might add, for the people who are involved with them to be used to this. And so it is not a matter of obscenity, it's simply a matter of taste. And if that answers any question concerning group ritual and sex.
Right. understand what you all, they're not doing it out of lust or whatever. Okay.
Not lust of result, my dear. Right. Lust and lust of result are two different things.
Absolutely. Okay. What is the OTO's position on modern paganism and Wicca, et cetera?
Again, I have that feeling. When I was reading, when I was working on my master's degree in political theory about the Weimar Republic, there was always these politicians standing around the corners orating about, and this is my standpunkt, if I understand it, standpunkt, their standpoint. Well, if that was, and on this they were going to rally the revolution or something. Well, you see, the OTO has a sort of a floating standpoint. It happens to be the book of the law. And in other words, we interpret the book of the law as best we can. We simply know that it is right. But a position on modern paganism, we don't have a position on it, except this. Historically, we've discovered, happily, that the pagan movement in Northern California, at least, and in a goodly part of another part of the country, has been a very fertile ground for finding people who wanted to be Thelemites and just didn't get around to knowing truly until the OTO came along. We have a temple of Thelemic Wicca. Chandria, a high priestess of Thelemic Wicca, has been issued a charter by me for a temple of Thelemic Wicca. And we get along beautifully with them, so far as we're concerned. We have no antagonism to Gerald Gardner. Our only antagonism ever was that we simply felt he was a little old Aeon, maybe. Maybe he wasn't enough trolley, possibly. But absolutely none, and we've had the most beautiful relations ourselves. What other parts of the country, your Thelemites in other parts of the country, obviously have different backgrounds. And in Connecticut, they may have Satanists, for all I know. But in any case, in Florida, and so forth. So it really depends upon where you are in this country as your role or position concerning paganism. As for Satanism, the classic Thelemic position is, quote, Satanism is a Christian problem, unquote, because, as far as we're concerned, Satanism has to do with the reverse of Christianity, and we don't quite understand what you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay. What is BAA? This is a matter of definition of what is known publicly and what is known privately. What is known publicly is it was founded by Aleister Crowley in Mexico in some year, which is, you'll find in the book references someplace, and means a silver star, and it has as a contains the inner mysteries of the Order Templi Orientis. We think of the AA as being the flaming core of the OTO, but we think of it that way. But we make no hard dogmatic claims because AA is completely private and in a sense has nothing to do with the OTO. But we look at it this way. The OTO affirms of a physical foundation of order members and organization, within which framework the AA can work as it will. We have authentic lineage of AA from Jeff Liu, Jane Wolfe, New Aleister Crowley, and so forth on down the line. As to those of us now who are in AA, of course, we do not discuss this because AA candidacy is a purely personal matter. Very few things can be said about it publicly. Its motto is that the brothers of AA are women. I have to start all over. You got it someplace in the writing, of course. The candidates from AA are men. The brothers of AA are women. And this is one of those mysteries of tantric androgyny that Crowley discusses so beautifully in the holy books, Heart Wit with a Serpent, for example. In other words, the information is available. It's like everything else. The person who is to be involved with AA is already knows it. Is simply looking for it. Shall we go on?
What is the Gnostic Catholic Church?
Lola, I'm going to ask you for a credential along that line, since it's a very refreshing to me as patriarch of the Gnostic Catholic Church to be able to ordain female bishops of the Gnostic Catholic Church.
Okay. Well, the Gnostic Catholic Church has an ancient heritage, which of course is as ancient as the Catholic, because they also trace their lineage through the bishops all the way back to Peter, because the people who brought the heritage of the Gnostics down to us are people who were never captured and burned as heretics and escaped the burning. Therefore, for people that are into that type of thing, you know, and it's important or interesting to them to have this continuity, it seems to appeal to. And also, I think the Gnostic Church appeals to people who like to have more of a spiritual feeling and experience of having a church-centered worship service and so forth. Some people are just into this type of thing. They like the continuity of the energy weekly being generated, and they like the different things for whatever reasons it might be. So it's a, the Gnostic Catholic Church is an associate organization. People who belong to the Gnostic Catholic Church may or may not be members of the OTO. It's not a mandatory thing. You can belong to the one without the other. So it has its own certification through the state, authorizing it as being a legitimate church. It has its own separate board of directors and people, and it has the wandering bishops, and also there are a few landed bishops in the church itself. And other than that, it's a ceremony. The Mass itself is written by Aleister Crowley, and that's the main tie-in between it and what we do in the order itself. They presently hold their Sunday worship services at 6 o'clock in our temple, which is actually OTO operated and so forth, but that's where the Gnostic Catholic Church convenes on Sunday.
Did you mention the incorporation?
That they are an incorporated church.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
We have the ancient tradition, but to provide it a physical basis, we've incorporated it in the state of California, and hope that this will, of course, continue continuously.
Yes, under the name of the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica.
Yes, EGC, we've heard of it. Oh, I might add, since I'm also patriarch of that, in regard to the magical operation of the establishment of the caliphate, as I said, I decided to accept the burden of the caliphate. And I established that by the ancient magical doctrine that when you undertake a major magical operation, you should have two witnesses, the two eyes of Horus, if you will recall. In this instance, I chose them very carefully, both people who had also known Foley as I had known him. So that would make three of us. I sat down and typed a letter to Gerald York in England, and I'm sure you have his address. And I wrote a letter to Dr. Israel Rigardi, who's now known as Francis Rigardi to his friends, who at that time was living in Studio City, California. This was in 1970. And the return address would have been San Francisco or Dublin, California. And I said I decided to accept the burden of the caliphate, which meant by activating the documents of authorization Crowley had given me to take over the entire responsibility to reorganize the order as it was at that time in California, which was the 1940s. But now in
The next question is, what are your personal and organizational relations to other orders in general, such as the Order of the Cubic Stone?
We have no relation, personal or organizational, I know of.
Okay, what are our personal or organizational relations to the IOT?
None. I don't even know what it is. It's offhand.
How about Fraternitas Saturni?
We have in the archives of the Caliph three publications from the 1920s put out by Saturni. They're beautiful publications. It was before Hitler busted the entire occult scene in Germany, if I understand it correctly. But in any case, other than that, I understand there's been some correspondence with people claiming such titles in Germany, but we have I have no personal relation that I know of, just offhand. And organizationally, there might be somebody in Germany claiming the title, which I'm not quite aware. But let's say offhand, I don't know of anybody that we recognize as an organization with which we have dealings.
Okay. What are your personal and organizational relations to Phi to Freemasonry?
We are the original Freemasons because we are the Templars. We know this by the Encyclopedia says so. The 32nd degree readings of the Masons say so. And I might add, I can furnish you a Xerox copy if you wish. And our prophet says so, Alfred Rose says so, in the Blue Equinox. And you will, all you have to do is read in there in the chapters on, in regard to our relations to Masonry and Baphomet, and you'll find that it's already written in the documents.
Okay, what is your position regarding the authenticity of other OTOs, such as Grant?
Well, we do not have any position on them in the sense that if we could have relations with them, we would. Grant has never contacted me, and I have never contacted him recently, personally. I met Kenneth Grant once. I met him at Alistair Crowley's presence and the Bell Inn at Aston Clinton in England, and this, I presume, it must have been around Christmas of 1944, unless it was, it had to be because he didn't move out of London until later. But in any case, after the German bomb blew in his back window there at 93 German Street. In any case, I met him, but I have never corresponded with him, and he has never corresponded with me, so we've never had any occasion to have any relation. Who's the next one?
Mota.
As for Mr. Mota, Mr. Mota has sued Weiser's for the right to publish Alistair Crowley, for all of Alistair Crowley's copyrights, if I understand it correctly. We feel that he does not have that right, and that and we have given our assistance to try to keep that from happening. He's suing Weiser's, and for with the hope that he can get establish his copyrights, so we hope he'll lose the suit.
Okay, and let us go on then to Metzger.
Mr. Metzger, Frater Peregrinus. I had some correspondence with Frater Peregrinus, 1969-1970. He sent me a copy of his manifesto that he was OHO, and several copies of several of his Oriflamma publication, but our correspondence ceased when I refused to recognize him as outer head of the order. And the reason I refused to recognize him as outer head of the order, although I grant that Carl Gerber did give him an authentic charter for a chapter or whatever, a lodge in Switzerland, that is only one country and he's only one lodge. And what he had done is simply called his, if I understand it correctly, called his lodge together and voted himself out ahead of the order. But that's a world title. And it's established in the Blue Equinox. It'll be voted on by 10th degrees. And 10th degrees are national heads. And so until the OTO has enough national heads to vote for OHO, we won't have one formally. I am Caliph, or Caliph, as they say in the Orient. When we, Alistair Crowley's OTOs are called to establish our lineage from prophet to caliph, or caliph if you prefer, then we will have a formal organizational OHO at the time we have enough countries that have 10th degrees, national heads. And we're working on it at the present time. We have bodies in Canada, Norway, Australia, New Zealand, etc.
Okay. How do you look on the world's future in general and on that of the OTO in particular?
I look on the world's future in general as being in this condition bordering on great upheaval. I believe the 1980s will be a time of turbulence. And I look on the OTO's role as being a stabilizing influence as we achieve our own true will and to attempt to, as best we can, keep the psychic currents flowing in the truth-living tradition, and that being the case, we should be able to ride through it.
All right. Is there any address our readers could contact in Germany, Switzerland, etc., etc.? And I've put in a copy of our latest OTO newsletter, and it has a list of the various chapters and encampments in the different countries that we have at the present time. So. He'll be able to just look at that. So is there anything you want to say, Grady? That's the last of the questions
yes.
And so forth.
As you know, I was a soldier in World War II, and I did see Germany under somewhat adverse conditions, and I would like very much to be able to
see Germany again under blessed conditions one of these days, and so hopefully I'll be visiting you at your convenience, as the case may be. And so, 93, and live as of all love and your will.
Yes. Hail and farewell.
Question's been asked as to what Jack Parsons is going to die. Well, what it came down to was this. I was privileged to see the test block, the original test block in the Arroyo Seco Norte in the Rose Bowl there in Pasadena on a particular afternoon, and it was 38, 39, something like that. And he was a genius in chemistry at Caltech, and he was developing rocket fuel. But by the time he died, he'd gone through the fiasco with Ron Hubbard. And he decided to split for Mexico. Why, I don't know exactly. But they're going to set up some kind of explosive plant on it. I don't know whether it was a tax write-off or whatever it was that made him want to go to Mexico. But anyway, that's what he decided to do. He was still married to Candy. In the process of transferring his laboratory from the garage where it had been stored to the trailer where he was going to drive it to Mexico, he dropped a can of potassium,
mercury
fulminate, right? And it blew him apart. Mm. And the question was this intentional or not? And,
is it true that his last words were, I can't go, you have too much work left to do?
That's what came with him.
Wow. Okay. Well, I guess he could laugh.
That's why we debated it. He wanted for years. Was this intentional or not intentional? And the ultimate solution, more or less, was a fitting point, of course, who was talking to was, to me.
But
anyway.
Didn't he like to use masculine a lot?
We don't know whether he had masculine. We do know that he did have pumps.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes your astral hand can have a grip on something and physical, like it sucks away.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. We don't know whether he had access to masculine. We do know he had access to pump because, some of the people around South Tree, Orange Grove, said that they'd seen Mr. Connicat fall by and drop off and all this that. And once in a while, Parsons would get really hooked up in the morning and call into the jet prop lab there at Caltech, you know, and say that he was not doing well. And sit around being stoned all day writing poetry.
Did he have any physical children that he left behind?
Not to the best of my knowledge. None. I do matter. I don't know.
What exact date did he die?
Okay. 52.
Must
have been August. The way I discovered Jack Parsons is dead. Nobody bothered to write to me and tell me. Anyway, I was in the Army, I was in Korea. I'd been in Korea for almost a year. I was up on the Eastern Front there in Tinsport. And one day I had to go to the local laboratory, which happened to be a shack, of course, with three holes stuck in a piece of board. And the cold Korean air blowing up the crack of your ass. I picked up this magazine called People Today, August 13, 1952. And it had this, the civil section had to do with the death of Jack Parsons of the L.A. Lux Cup. And you see now, this exact date, it doesn't give exact date, Mary mentioned stuff, and then got me to the
doctor. What's the date on the
paper? This is August 13, 52. So obviously it had to happen before then.
So then you find out that your best friend is dead, just on accident.
Well, it wasn't me anyway.
A cold shot.
Well, we'll be not right along. Okay. Now, had you joined the order by this time? Oh, I mean, wait. Let me digress. Just, oh, here, sit this man. Okay. Okay, we were going to digress back to you had met Parsons, and he was corresponding with Crowley and so forth at this time. How about you? When did you either join the order or start to correspond with Crowley?
You were wrong. Parsons was not corresponding with Crowley. This brings up something which might as well go on the record, and that is this. That has to do with hierarchy in the order. For example, a lot of people think that I'm much too stringent in some of my regulations. The truth of the matter is, I'm extremely liberal with thought. In those days, nobody knew Schroeder's address. Nobody knew Carl Gerber's address. They taught in an ancient Masonic tradition that the higher degrees are out of your reach. And you didn't want to communicate with them. They communicate with you. They want to, but you're not communicating with them. And so therefore, nobody knew either Gerber's address. It was quite a while before people discovered Gerber's address, and eventually Schroeder's address. So, as a matter of fact, probably wasn't until I got to England.
It's like being a secret chief.
In those days, it was sort of like that. Okay, fine.
That would be a good thing, I'm saying, certainly.
In certain ways, that's very right. I'm sure it was the second part of the question.
When did you join the order?
It'd be funny. I joined the order, and I would think this off at 1939. The reason I can't be exactly sure, of course, is due to what was the war and everything else. I've also taken papers. But in any case, it had to be about 39 because I was in the Army with 30 or 41. I didn't get the best deal until September 37. So therefore, and what happened was this, that after having gotten acquainted with Parsons at this party in Hollywood for the California Rocket Society, I still have four issues of the American Rocket Society magazine at that time, which we granted because of our associate membership. I became, shall we say, well established there, like on weekends. It was my habit to hang out there at Harris Drive there, which is a nice company place. And I had some beautiful memories of it. For example, one night, we had a habit in those days which you might find at least nostalgic, thank you, at least nostalgic. See, in those days we weren't into plastic. 33 and a half inches. We had those old 72 inch.
78.
78, right, thank you for telling me. Vinyl, heavy as hell, right. And they were also vulnerable. So that, for example, in other words, they were easy to chip or wear out. So we had the leaders in technology at the time, and that was cactus needles. And cactus needles, that's right. And you had a little thing that was sort of like a pencil sharpener, only it was for, it was very small. That's right. You put these cactus needles in this pencil sharpener, and you grind down the cactus needles.
That's cute.
It was cute. Yeah, that's something right out of the 1930s. Something you would never think of.
No.
But it's true, right? So if you're doing a film, for example, and you have that scenario in it, people go hate because who ever heard of cactus needles, right?
Yeah, really. That's funny. Yeah. It was only back about 1964 or 5 that they invented a needle that would play either stereo or mono records. And the man that invented just a simple little device, so people didn't have to have two cartridges, made a fortune, just off a small percentage you got on the copyright or how did you get on patent.
I'm talking about needles.
Just were waiting. Okay, so you love being these afternoons you spend at Jack Parsons' house, and you were going to discuss how you got into the order then, or started reading about Crowley.
Okay, did we get the part about the cactus needles on the tape?
Yes, we got that.
Got that, okay.
Yeah.
All right, so one day Jack Parsons says to me, "Where is the guy over in Hollywood I think you'd like to meet?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Yeah, that's what we go in." So the next time they had a meeting on the weekend over there at the Boulevard, where Augusty Lodge was, there's Wilford Smith doing the priest, and Regina Call. And Wilford Smith was a little shrimp of a guy, and Regina Call was a big square gal from Texas, built sort of like a rock. And let's see, that night, Luke Carroll was doing the deacon trip. Lieutenant, well, he was a, like a sometimes good actor in Hollywood, so was sometimes King Wolf, I'm sorry, King Wolf, the ship. And that's when he was covered up with coal mine. It was first funny. It came down like this, not through the book of the law at all. It was like, we're standing there, and they, we're upstairs. Well, Regina has welcomed us. She was a teacher of court voice at UCLA campus in the East. And so anyway, she welcomed us with her sweetest smile and so forth. I understand from people who lived at the house that she could be a real virago when she wanted it. But in any case, it was a sweet smile and she welcomed us. And some guy, how about shutting the door? Some guy played like NBC's something cathedral on the piano. And I'm sitting here in this booth with my two girlfriends sitting across from me. One of them is Foxy and one of them is Tommy. They're dressed identically alike. Foxy is a big buxom blonde chick that would later be my wife. Tommy is a small short chick, and she's also has that beautiful skin that's going to wrinkle, you know, at a very early age. It's been kind of very beautiful, you know, really sexy type, you know. And they're both dressed identical. I think you should go in a movie scenario or something. It was like this. They were roommates, and they had these red jumpers over white blouses, because you didn't get the picture right. Mm-hmm. And they were sitting around like twin dolls, as it were, one day you want to call. And Regina, and here's this, little booth over here, and here's the front room, and Regina's standing here on the stairs here, where she's at the living room, and then of course up there, is a second one, right? And then up there is, of course, second one. And up there in the, not the dock room, but the, under the eaves, there's this, what they call a gable. And that's where the altar is. And they got something. So, I got acquainted with these people. And like one night, how I got to be, how I became a Solomon. Anyway. One night, now that that temple was big enough so that you could have people on both sides of the altar, right? Unfortunately, we don't have the temple here in the current temple, but we got what we got. But it was. Now, we did not divide up the men and say the men stand here and the women stand there. This is sort of like how, this is sort of the way it came down. It's not like that. Anyway, we come down to the college. To the point where, Chapman World Act, Wonder Tree, we're all speaking together. And I look around, these are sitting right on my right and my left. You know, these are the people I came down to meet. These are the people I came down to find. And that's what I'm looking for.
That's how I felt when I came down to order here.
Now, anyway, to pick up on the Jack Parsons narrative. So, a few months later, it was agreed that there'd be an initiation at Gogarty Lodge in Vermilion Boulevard in Hollywood. And for reasons that still a mystery to me, but nobody ever bothered to explain it to me, it seems that in those days they had developed, they had so, shall we say, edited the Minerval and First Degree Initiation trips. We did it both in one night, which is why when I met Crowley of the First Degree, of course, whether it's a gentleman or not, I don't know, but damn sure knows, damn sure it means, because it worked, and for what I could tell, they did a lot of work in it, you know. But even to this day, I remember some of the scenes from it, you know. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, how I would reconstruct it, I really wouldn't know. It's all planned. I mean, it takes a lot of thinking to reconstruct something like that. It would have been an earlier version of it. So, I went through that. And Jack Parsons wants to pay by dues.